You might even teach positive thinking to your patients, as well as to your employees, so that the positive energy is optimized when bloodletting takes place. Can you imagine what happened when the germ theory was discovered? When Semmelweis of Hungary and Pasteur of France and other empirical scientists discovered that germs are a primary cause of disease? It immediately explained why women wanted to be delivered by midwives. The midwives were cleaner. They washed. It explained why more men on war's battlefields were dying from staph infections than bullets. The disease was spread behind the front ranks through germs. The germ theory opened whole new fields of research and guides health care practices to the present day. That's the power of an accurate map or an accurate paradigm. It explains, and then it guides. But the problem is that paradigms, like traditions, die hard. Flawed paradigms go on for centuries after a better one is discovered. For instance, even though history books talk about George Washington dying of a throat infection, he probably died of bloodletting. The throat infection was the symptom of something else. Since the paradigm was that the bad stuff was in the blood, they took from him several pints of blood in a 24-hour period. You and I are counseled not to give more than one pint every 2 months if we're well. You see, the new knowledge worker age is based on a new paradigm, one entirely different from the thing paradigm of the industrial age. Let's call it the whole person paradigm. At the core of the whole person paradigm, there is one simple overarching reason why so many people remain unsatisfied in their work, and why most organizations fail to draw out the greatest talent, ingenuity, and creativity of their people, and never really become great enduring organizations. It stems from an incomplete paradigm of who we are, our fundamental view of human nature. The fundamental reality is human beings are not things needing to be externally motivated and controlled and managed. They are four-dimensional: body, mind, heart, and spirit. Again, body, mind, heart, and spirit. If you study all philosophy and religion, both Western and Eastern, from the beginning of recorded history, you'll basically find the same four dimensions: the physical slash economic, the mental, the social slash emotional, and the spiritual. Different words are often used, but they reflect the same four universal dimensions of life. They also represent the four basic needs and motivations of all people, illustrated in the film in the first chapter: to live, that is survival; to love, having to do with relationships; to learn, that is mental growth and development; and to leave a legacy, in other words, meaning, contribution, integrity. These are all internal, not external motivators. New heading: people have choices. So what's the direct connection between the controlling thing, that is a part-person paradigm, that dominates today's workplace, and the inability of managers and organizations to inspire their people to volunteer their highest talents and contributions? The answer is simple. People make choices. Consciously or subconsciously, people decide how much of themselves they will give to their work depending on how they are treated and on their opportunities to use all four parts of their nature. These choices range from rebelling or quitting to creative excitement. Let me briefly state what these six choices are. First, rebel or quit. Second, malicious obedience. Third, willing compliance. Fourth, cheerful cooperation. Fifth, heartfelt commitment. Sixth, or creative excitement. Now let's discuss each in turn in relation to how you're being treated. First, let's say you're not treated fairly. That is, there's a lot of politics at play in your organization. There's nepotism. The pay system just doesn't seem fair and just. And your own pay does not accurately reflect the level of your contribution. What would your choice be? Remember the six: rebel or quit, malicious obedience, willing compliance, cheerful cooperation, heartfelt commitment, or creative excitement. So what would your choice be if there's no sense of fairness? Second, let's say that you are treated fairly in terms of your pay, but you are not treated kindly. That is, you are not respected, your treatment is inconsistent, arbitrary, capricious, perhaps largely dictated by the mood of your boss. Now what would your choice be? Rebel or quit, malicious obedience, willing compliance, cheerful cooperation, heartfelt commitment, or creative excitement? Third, now let's say that you are paid fairly and treated kindly. But when your opinion is wanted, it is given to you. In other words, your body and heart are valued, but not your mind. Now what would your choice be? Fourth, now let's say that you are paid fairly, that is for the body, treated kindly, the heart, involved creatively, the mind, but you are asked to dig a hole and fill it again, or to make out reports that no one ever sees or uses. In other words, the work is meaningless. That's the spirit side, see? Now what would your choice be? Fifth, now let's say that you're paid fairly, treated kindly, and involved creatively in meaningful work. But there's a lot of lying and cheating going on with customers and suppliers. A lot of manipulation and duplicity. Even involving other employees. In other words, the spirit of integrity isn't there. What would your choice be now? Now notice we went through all four parts of a whole person paradigm. Body, mind, heart, and spirit. The spirit being divided in two parts, that is the meaningfulness of the work and the unprincipled way that it is being done. The point is, if you neglect any one of the four parts of human nature, any one of them, you turn a person into a thing. And what do you do with things? You have to manage them. You have to control and carrot and stick them in order to motivate them. Motivation becomes external. Then you sandwich technique, the performance appraisal, and carrot and stick more. The great jackass theory of human motivation. So fundamentally insulting and repugnant to the full sense of what a human being is. You know what? I've asked these five questions all around the world in different settings, and almost inevitably the answer falls into the bottom three categories, that people would either rebel or quit, or they would maliciously obey, meaning they'll do it but they actually hope it doesn't work, or at best they'll willingly comply. But in today's information knowledge worker age, only one who is respected as a whole person in a whole job, one who is paid fairly, treated kindly, used creatively, and given opportunities to serve human needs in principled ways, makes one of the upper three choices: cheerful cooperation, heartfelt commitment, or creative excitement. Can you begin to see how the core problems in the workplace today and the core solution to those problems lie in our paradigm of human nature? Can you begin to see how many of the solutions to the problems in our homes and communities lie in this same paradigm? You see, the industrial age thing paradigm and all of the practices and systems and structures that flow from it are the modern day equivalent of bloodletting. A comprehensive description of the four chronic problems in organizations caused by neglecting the four parts of human nature, and then the solution involves the four roles of leadership. We'll begin in chapter 6. However, we must first deal with the individual response and solution to the pain and problems we've discussed. In other words, this is an inside-out approach, like the pebble thrown into the pond. Chapter 3, The Solution. Henry David Thoreau once wrote, "There are 1,000 hacking at the branches of evil to one who is striking at the root." This book is dedicated to striking at the root of the significant problems we face. We started with the pain. Then we explored the underlying problem, one that has personal roots and that involves a deeply embedded paradigm and set of traditions in the workplace. Now let's set the context for the solution and give an overview of how it will be unfolded in the remainder of the book. I've worked with organizations around the world for over 40 years and have been a student of the findings of the great minds who have studied organizations. Most of the great cultural shifts, ones that have built great organizations that sustain long-term growth, prosperity, and contribution to the world, started with the choice of one person. Sometimes that one person was the formal leader, the CEO or president. Very often it started with someone else, a professional, a line manager, someone's assistant. Regardless of their position, these people first change themselves from the inside out. Their character, competence, initiative, and positive energy, in short, their moral authority, inspired and lifted others. They possessed an anchored sense of identity. They discovered their strengths and talents, their voice, and used them to meet needs and produce results. People noticed. They were given more responsibility. They magnified the new responsibility and again produced results. More and more people sat up and noticed. Top people wanted to learn of their ideas, how they accomplished so much. Little by little, the culture was drawn to their vision and to them. People like this just don't get sucked into or pulled down for long by all of the negative, demoralizing, insulting forces in the organization. Interestingly, their organizations are no better than most organizations. In fact, to some degree, all organizations are a mess. These people just realize that they just can't wait for their boss or for the organization to change. They become an island of excellence in a sea of mediocrity, and it's contagious. Where does a person get such internal strength to swim against the current and to withstand negative cultural provocations, to subordinate selfish interests, and develop and sustain such vision and determination? They learn of their true nature and gifts. They use them to develop a vision of great things they want to accomplish. With wisdom, they take initiative and cultivate great understanding of the needs and opportunities around them. They meet those needs that match their unique talents, that tap their highest motivations, and that make a difference. In short, they find and use their voice. They create their voice. They serve and inspire others. They apply principles that govern growth and prosperity in human beings and in organizations, principles that draw the highest and best from a whole person, body, mind, heart, and spirit. Equally significant, they also choose to influence and inspire others to find their voice through these principles as well. This two-part solution, find your voice and inspire others to find theirs, is a roadmap for individuals at any level of an organization to maximize their fulfillment and influence, to become an irreplaceable contributor, and to inspire their team and the broader organization to do the same. Accordingly, the rest of the book is organized into two main sections which embody the eighth habit, The first section, Find Your Voice. The second section, Inspire Others to Find Their Voice. Let's briefly introduce each, and this will give you an overview. The poet Robert Frost wrote, Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all of the difference. Listen again to this well-quoted statement. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all of the difference. Everyone chooses one of two roads in life, whether they're young or old, the rich or poor, men and women alike. One of these roads is the broad, well-traveled road to mediocrity. The other road to greatness and meaning. The range of possibilities that exist within each of these two dimensions is as wide as the diversity of gifts and personalities in the human family. But the contrast between the two destinations is as the night is to the day. In reality, there's a continuum of roads, not just an either-or. So as you listen, try to discern where on this continuum your road might be. The road to mediocrity straitjackets human potential. The road to greatness unleashes and realizes human potential. The path to mediocrity is the quick fix, shortcut approach to life. The path to greatness is a process of sequential growth from the inside out. Travelers on the lower path to mediocrity live out the cultural software of ego, indulgence, scarcity, comparison, competitiveness, and victimism. Travelers on the upper road to greatness rise above negative cultural influences and choose to become the creative force of their lives. One word expresses the pathway to greatness. Voice. Those on this path find or create their voice and inspire or enable others to find and create theirs. The rest never do. New heading. The soul's search for meaning. Deep within each one of us, there is an inner longing to lead a life of greatness and contribution. To really matter, to really make a difference. We may doubt ourselves and our ability to do so, but I want you to know of my deep conviction that you can live such a life. You have the potential within you. We all do. It is the birthright of the human family. I once visited with the commander of a military base who was truly on fire with this commitment to undertake a significant cultural change inside his organization. He had been in the service for over 30 years, was a full colonel, and was eligible for retirement that very year. After he had been teaching and training his organization for many months, I asked him why he planned to stay on and undertake such a major initiative, one that would require swimming upstream against the tremendous resisting forces of tradition, lethargy, indifference, and low trust. I even said to him, "You could relax. You could have a good retirement. Award banquets would be held in your honor. Loved ones and associates would celebrate you." He became very sober, paused for a long time, and then decided to share with me a very personal, almost sacred experience. He said that his father had recently passed away. When his father was on his deathbed, he called his wife and son, that is the colonel, to his bedside to say goodbye. He could barely speak. His wife wept during the entire visit. The son drew down close to his father, and his father whispered into his ear, "Son, don't do life like I did. I didn't do right by you or by your mother, and I never really made a difference. Son, promise me you won't do life like I did." Those were the last words the colonel heard from his father, who passed away shortly thereafter. But he regarded them as the greatest gift and legacy his father could have ever given him. He made up his mind right there and then that he was going to make a difference in every area of his life. Later, the colonel told me privately that he had been planning to retire and relax. In fact, he had secretly hoped that his successor would not do as well as he had, and that this would be obvious and apparent to all. But when he had this epiphany with his father, he determined to not only become a change catalyst in building principles of enduring leadership into the culture of his command, but also to see to it that his successor would be more successful than he had been, by striving to institutionalize these leadership principles into the structures, systems, and processes of his organization, he would increase the likelihood of passing on his legacy one leader generation to another. He said further that up until that experience with his father, he had knowingly taken the easier road, the lower road, acting basically in a custodial role in the traditions of the past, and that he had chosen a life of mediocrity. But with his father, he resolved as never before to live a life of greatness, a life of real contribution, a life of significance, one that really made a difference. All of us can consciously decide, choose to leave behind a life of mediocrity and to live a life of greatness at home, at work, and in the community. First, at home. No matter what our circumstances may be, such a decision can be made by every one of us, whether that greatness is manifest by choosing to have a magnificent spirit in the face of an incurable disease, or by simply making a difference in the life of a child, or giving another child a sense of worth and potential, or by becoming a change catalyst inside an organization, or by becoming an initiator of a great cause in society, or a combination of all these initiatives. We all have the power to decide to live a great life, or even simpler, to not only have a good day, but to have a great day. No matter how long we've walked life's pathway to mediocrity, we can always choose to switch paths, to switch roads, always. It's never too late. We can find our voice. We can create our voice. Once you make the choice to follow this road less traveled, the pathway to finding your own voice is first discover or create your voice by coming to understand your true nature, by what I call the three magnificent birth gifts outlined in chapter 4, and by developing and using with integrity the intelligence tied to each of the four parts of your nature. Then second, to express your voice by cultivating the highest manifestations of these human intelligences: vision, discipline, passion, and conscience. This will be discussed in chapter 5. Vision, discipline, passion, governed by conscience. And now the film, a beautiful film called The Discovery of a Character. This is a powerful true story that embodies the process of finding or creating your own voice. Several years ago, our firm participated with our local PBS station in broadcasting a video dramatization we developed and filmed in England. The central figure in this remarkable story is an Englishman who transcended a childhood spent as a street urchin to become a reasonably successful writer with a nice home and a loving family. At the time of the story, however, he had developed writer's block. It seemed his creativity had turned off, and his debts were mounting. He was under tremendous deadline pressure from his publisher. He was becoming more and more depressed. He began to fear that his own children would end up on the streets, like so many others that he saw around him, and that he himself, as a youth, had experienced, particularly when his father was in debtor's prison. He was discouraged. He couldn't sleep. He began to spend his nights walking the streets of London. He saw the poverty, the inhumane conditions of children working nights in the factories, the terrible struggle of parents trying to eke out a living for their families. Gradually, the full reality of what he was seeing began to hit him, the impact of selfishness and greed on those who would take advantage of others. An idea touched his heart and began to grow in his mind. There was something he could do that would make a difference. He returned to his writing with an energy and an enthusiasm he had never known. The vision of contribution impassioned and consumed him. He no longer felt doubt or discouragement. He didn't worry about his own financial concerns. He wanted to get this story out, to make it as inexpensive as possible, to make it available to as many people as possible. His whole life had changed. He found his voice. I invite you now to watch this brief film that dramatizes this remarkable man's experience, who became one of the greatest writers in history. You can view it by inserting the DVD into your DVD player and selecting Discovery of a Character. I believe you'll be inspired by the rest of his story. New heading. Inspire others to find their voice. This deals with the second part of the book and the second part of Habit 8. Once you've found your own voice, the choice to expand your influence, to increase your contribution, is the choice to inspire others to find their voice. Inspire, from the Latin root inspirare, means to breathe life into another. As we recognize and respect and create ways for others to give voice to all four parts of their nature, physically, mentally, emotionally, socially, and spiritually, latent human genius, creativity, passion, talent, and motivation are unleashed. It will be those organizations that reach a critical mass of people and teams expressing their full voice that will achieve next-level breakthrough in productivity, innovation, and leadership in the marketplace and society. Part 2 of the 8th Habit begins with Chapter 6. It is to inspire others to find their voice. Since most of the world's work is done in organizations, the focus is on principles you can apply to positively influence others in any organization, whether it be business or education, government, military, community, and most significantly, family. Most likely, you will also have many practical, but questions come to your mind. To assist you, you will find a brief section of commonly asked questions and my responses at the end of each remaining chapter. Following the last chapter of the book, you will also find a chapter dedicated to questions and answers that are more general and comprehensive in nature. Next heading, getting the most out of this book. In other words, learning by teaching and by doing. If you'd like to get the most out of this book and initiate powerful change and growth in your life and organizations, and to get on that higher road toward greatness, I recommend two simple ideas to you. If you will do these two things, I guarantee dramatic results. The first is teach others what you learn. Share what you learn. The second is to systematically apply what you learn. In other words, to do it. To be a doer, not just a hearer. Let's look at the first one. Teach and share as you go. Almost everyone acknowledges you learn best when you teach another, and that your learning is internalized when you live it. While teaching at a university a few years ago, I met a visiting professor, Dr. Walter Gong, from San Jose, California. He taught a one-semester class for faculty entitled, How to Improve Your Teaching. The essence of his program was this great principle. The best way to get people to learn is to turn them into teachers. In other words, you learn the material best when you teach it. This is a paradigm shift. The fastest way to change a person's paradigm is to change their role. When you see your role as a teacher instead of a learner, your paradigm has shifted and you become a better learner. I immediately started to apply that principle in my work and at home. When I first started teaching university classes, my classes averaged about 15 to 30 students. When I started applying Dr. Gong's principle, I found that I could effectively teach many more students. In fact, some of my classes were packed with nearly 1,000 students. And yet the students' performance and test scores actually went up. Then with the small classes. Why? When you teach, you simply learn better. The paradigm has shifted. Every student becomes a teacher, and every teacher a student. Now, the common paradigm is that the teacher-student ratio is critical. Fewer students mean higher quality teaching. But by turning your students into teachers, you gain leverage. You have a one-to-one relationship. You simply move the fulcrum over. Also, when you teach or share what you are learning with others, you implicitly commit socially to live what you teach. Because you are teaching it, you will naturally be more motivated to live it. This sharing will be a basis for deepening your learning, your commitment, and your motivation, making change legitimate, and enrolling others as a support team. You will also find that sharing creates bonding with people, especially with your children. Have them regularly teach you what they are learning in school. My wife Sandra and I have found that by doing this simple thing essentially eliminates any need for external motivation with our children and their studies. Those who teach what they are learning are by far the greatest students. Now let's look at the second suggestion. That is to apply it, to do it. In other words, to integrate what you learn into your life. Because to know and not to do is really not to know. To learn and not to do is really not to learn. In other words, to understand something but not to apply it is really not to understand it. It is only in the doing, the applying, that knowledge and understanding are internalized. They become part of you. For instance, you could study tennis as a sport by reading books and hearing lectures. But until you're actually out there on the court playing, you really wouldn't know the sport. To know and not to do is not to know. There are at least four approaches you could take in applying what you learn in this audio book. The first would be simply to listen to the book straight through. Then decide what you want to apply in your life and work. This is the way most people approach a book. It reflects the desire many of us have to get emotionally and mentally connected with the flow of ideas in a book and then to run with it. The second approach would be to listen to the entire book and then use the comprehensive understanding and cumulative motivation to go back and to listen to the book a second time, this time with the intent to apply it as you go. This could work well for many people. A third approach, one that I personally believe will yield the greatest results, would be to adopt it as a year-long personal growth and development program. Take a month for each of the remaining 12 chapters. Start by listening to the next chapter. Watch the film. Then teach what you learn and apply it the rest of the month. you will find that if you will actually seek to apply what you learn in each chapter for a month, the insights you gain in the chapters that follow will profoundly increase. It's a kind of intellectual synergy where the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. The cumulative effect of this approach of teaching and applying what you learn in one chapter changes the very nature of your learning in the next chapter. It lifts it to an entirely new level. The fourth approach is simply to adapt the third approach to your own timeline. Some readers or listeners may want to go faster or slower than one chapter a month. Listen to and apply a new chapter every week, every 2 weeks, every 2 months, or in whatever time frame you choose. This retains the power of the third approach that allows you the flexibility to adapt it to your own desires and circumstances. To assist you in applying the principles in each chapter of the book, regardless of which approach you choose, I have set up a special website filled with application ideas, exercises, and tools. Simply go to www.theeighthhabit.com/offers. Again, www.theeighthhabit.com/offers. And the exercises and tools will be mailed to you at your request. I have also included on the last two-page spread of the audio workbook a chart that will assist you in completing what we could call the Eighth Habit Challenge. The challenge involves accomplishing developmental and action steps for each chapter. 1. Listen to the chapter. 2. Teach the chapter to at least 2 people, including work colleagues, family members, friends, etc. 3. Make a sincere, concerted effort to live the principles included in the chapter for 1 month. 4. Report the results and your learnings from seeking to live the ideas in the chapter to a trusted colleague, a family member, or friend. This is a kind of accountability that you establish for yourself. Once you have completed the entire Eighth Habit Challenge chart, you can certify that you have done so at www.theeighthhabit.com/challenge. Again, www.theeighthhabit.com/challenge, and you will receive a special recognition for your accomplishment. As we move now to part one, find your voice, consider the words of Abraham Lincoln. The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present. Close quote. We must think anew. We must develop not only a new mindset, but also a new skill set and a new tool set that flows from it. This is difficult to do. It throws everyone out of their comfort zones, but a new reality has emerged, a new economy, a new challenge. This new challenge, not only surviving, but truly thriving in this new reality, requires a new response. A new habit. Remember, habits lie at the intersection of knowledge, attitude, and skill. As you develop these three dimensions of the eighth habit, you'll increasingly become equal to the new challenge and to your unlimited possibilities. We now move into part one of the eighth habit. Find your voice. Chapter 4 in Part 1 is titled, Discover Your Voice, Unopened Birth Gifts. The power to discover, even create our voice, lies in the potential that was bequeathed us at birth. Latent and undeveloped, the seeds of greatness were planted. We were given magnificent birth gifts, talents, capacities, privileges, intelligences, opportunities that would remain largely unopened except through our own decision and effort. Because of these gifts, the potential within an individual is tremendous, even infinite. We really have no idea what a person is capable of. A baby may be the most dependent creation in the universe, and yet within a few short years, it becomes the most powerful. The more we use and magnify our present talents, the more talents we are given, and the greater our capacity becomes. Buckminster Fuller put it this way, "All children are born geniuses. 9,999 out of every 10,000 are swiftly, inadvertently, degeniusized by grown-ups." Let's examine our three most important gifts. First, our freedom and power to choose. Second, natural laws or principles, which are universal and never change. And third, our four intelligences or capacities in the four parts of our lives, the physical, economic, the emotional, social, the mental, and the spiritual. These four intelligences or capacities correspond to the four parts of our human nature, symbolized by body, heart, mind, and spirit. Author Marianne Williamson beautifully expressed how oftentimes we are awed, even fearful, of our native endowments, largely, I believe, because of the sense of responsibility they lay upon us. She puts it this way, "Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You are a child of God. Your playing small doesn't serve the world. There is nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We are all meant to shine as children do. We were born to make manifest the glory of God that is within us. It is not just in some of us, it is in everyone. And as we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As we're liberated from our own fear, our presence automatically liberates others." Close quote. Let's look at the first birth gift, the freedom to choose. For half a century, I've been involved in the subject of this book in many different contexts all around the world. If you were to ask me what one subject, one theme, one point seemed to have the greatest impact upon people, what one great idea resonated deeper in the soul than any other, if you were to ask what one ideal was most practical, most relevant, most timely, regardless of circumstances, I would answer quickly, without any reservation, and with the deepest conviction of my own heart and soul, that we are free to choose. Next to life itself, the power to choose is your greatest gift. This power and freedom stand in stark contrast to the mindset of victimism and the culture of blame so prevalent in society today. Fundamentally, we are a product of choice, not nature, that is our genes, or nurture, that is our upbringing and environment. Certainly, genes and culture often influence very powerfully, but they do not determine. And the difference between being influenced by and determined by is 180 degrees. The essence of being human is being able to direct your own life. Humans act. Animals and human robots react. Humans can make choices based on their values. Your power to choose the direction of your life allows you to reinvent yourself, to change your future, and to powerfully influence the rest of creation. You can become a change catalyst in breaking chains of habits and traditions that have gone through generations. The power to choose is the one gift that enables all of the other gifts to be used. It is the one gift that enables us to elevate our life to higher and higher levels. Over the years, in speaking to various groups, time and again, I have had people come up to me and basically say, "Please tell me more of my freedom and power to choose. Please tell me again of my worth and potential, that I have no need to compare myself with others." Many also comment that, as interesting or as boring as the speech may have been, the thing that literally electrified their souls was the internal sense of their own freedom to choose. This was so delicious to them, so exhilarating, that they could hardly ponder it long or deep enough. The power of choice means that we are not merely a product of the past or of our genes. We are not a product of how other people treat us. They unquestionably influence us, but they do not determine us. We are self-determining through our choices. If we have given away our present to the past, do we need to give away our future also? One of the most profound and truly life-changing experiences of my life, one conceptually fundamental to my work on the Seven Habits, took place while I was on a sabbatical in Hawaii. One day I was wandering leisurely around the stacks in a library. I was in a very meditative and reflective state of mind, and I pulled down a book. In it I read three sentences that staggered me to the core. They changed my life and my thinking. Here are the three sentences. Between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space lies our freedom and power to choose our response. In those choices lie our growth and our happiness. Let me restate those three. Think deeply about each one. Between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space lies our freedom and power to choose our response. In those choices lie our growth and our happiness. Intellectually, I had learned from many sources about our freedom to choose our response to whatever happens to us. But on that particular day, in that reflective mood, and in those relaxed circumstances, the idea of the space between whatever happens to us and our response to it hit me like a ton of bricks. Since then, I have come to understand and believe that the size of the space is largely determined by our genetic or biological inheritance and by our upbringing and present circumstances. With many who have grown up with unconditional love in supportive circumstances, the space may be very large. With others, due to various genetic and environmental influences, it may be very small. But the key point is, there is still a space there. And it is in the use of that space that the opportunity to enlarge it exists. Some with a very large space, when facing adverse circumstances, may choose to cave in, thereby reducing the size of the space between stimulus and response. Others with a small space may swim upstream against powerful genetic, social, and cultural currents and find their freedom expanding, their growth accelerating, and their happiness deepening. The former simply do not open this most priceless of all birthday gifts. Gradually, they become a function more of their conditions than their decisions. The latter, perhaps stumblingly and with great sustained effort, open this priceless gift of freedom to choose and discover the force that releases almost all of the other gifts given at birth. The maverick psychiatrist R.D. Lang captured in the words I will now quote how failing to notice that we have this space kills our ability to change. Humans alone have self-awareness. Now I'll give this quotation. Think deeply about his statement. The range of what we think and do is limited by what we fail to notice. And because we fail to notice that we fail to notice, there is little we can do to change until we notice how failing to notice shapes our thoughts and deeds. Close quote. In other words, he's talking about our self-awareness. Our very awareness of our freedom and power to choose is affirming because it can excite our sense of possibility and potential. It can also threaten, even terrify, because suddenly we're responsible. That is, response-able. We become accountable. If we've taken shelter over the years in explaining our situation and problems in the name of past or present circumstances, it is truly terrifying to think otherwise. Suddenly, there is no excuse. No matter what has happened, is now happening, or will happen, there is a space between those things and our response to them. If there is even a fraction of a second between stimulus and response, that space represents our power to choose our response to any situation. Certainly there are things that happen to us over which we have no choice. One such thing would be our genetic makeup. Though we do not choose our genes, we do have the power to choose how we respond to them. For instance, if you have a genetic predisposition to a particular disease, that doesn't necessarily mean that you get the disease. By using that self-awareness and your willpower to follow a regimen of proper exercise and nutrition and the most advanced medical wisdom, you may avoid the very illnesses or cancers that have taken your ancestors. Those who develop increasing internal power and freedom to choose can also become what I call a transition person, one who stops unworthy tendencies from being passed on from prior generations to those that follow, like your children and grandchildren and so forth. I was recently privileged to receive the Fatherhood Award from the National Fatherhood Initiative. I was deeply moved by what one of my fellow award recipients said upon receiving the award. His first comment was that this award was a greater honor and more important to him than any award he had ever received. Although other awards were evidence of a successful career, he viewed the National Fatherhood Award he was accepting as a far greater indicator of success. He said, and I'm paraphrasing, "I never knew my father. My father never knew his father. But my son knows his father." His statement truly represents one of the finest and most worthy successes in life. It indicates true greatness and success, but more importantly, his role as a transition person will profoundly impact generation after generation in immeasurably positive ways. You can also be a transition person in the organization you work for. For instance, you may have an absolutely awful boss. Your working circumstances may be not only unpleasant, but also unjust. However, by the wise exercise of your freedom to choose, you may change those circumstances and profoundly influence your boss for good, or at least insulate yourself from obsessing or being emotionally taken over by another's weaknesses. Remember, anytime your emotional life is a function of someone else's weaknesses, you disempower yourself and empower those weaknesses to continue to mess your life up. Again, yesterday holds tomorrow hostage. Here's a true story that powerfully illustrates our ability to choose. It is told firsthand by one courageous, inspiring person who learned to influence, even to lead, a so-called bad boss. Listen carefully to this story. When I came on board as Director of Human Resources, I heard horror stories about what my boss was like. I was actually in his office when he lost his temper with an employee. I vowed then and there never to get on my boss's bad side. I made good on that promise. I spoke nicely to him in the hallways. I had all my reports in on time to his secretary. I made sure I wasn't one of the last people out of the office for lunch, so that he wouldn't single me out. I didn't even want to play golf with him in case I beat him. A short time later, I started seeing myself in all my cowardly glory. I was consumed with things on the job that I had no control over. I'd spend precious, creative energy devising solutions to problems that hadn't even happened yet. Because I was scared, I wasn't giving the company my best effort. I wasn't an agent of change. In fact, the only change I felt comfortable instituting was me changing to another company. I even had an interview scheduled. Ashamed of myself, I canceled that interview and committed to focus only on those things I could truly influence for just 90 days. I began by deciding I wanted, above all, to create a sound relationship with my boss. We didn't have to be best buddies, but we did have to interact like colleagues. One day, my boss came into my office. After some discussion and after swallowing and practicing the words in my head a few times, I said, "By the way, what can I be doing to help you be more effective here?" He was perplexed. "What do you mean?" I bravely forged on. "What can I do to alleviate some of the pressure that you have in your job?" "It's my job to make sure your job gets easier." I gave him a big, sort of nervous, please-don't-think-I'm-weird smile. I'll never forget the look on his face. That was really the beginning point of our relationship. At first, I was asked to do just little things, things that I really wouldn't screw up, like, "Type this memo up for me," or "Do you mind making this call for me?" After 6 weeks of doing that, he came to me and said, "I understand with your background you know workers' comp pretty well. Do you mind working on this aspect of insurance? Our rates are high. See what you can do." It was the first time he had asked me to do anything that had a significant impact on the organization. I took a $250,000 a year premium and got it reduced to $198,000. Plus, I got them to waive the fee for terminating midstream on our contract by negotiating over some mishandled claims. This was an additional saving of $13,000. Once, when we had a disagreement, I proved to him that it stayed behind closed doors. He didn't hear about it later from the marketing department. I soon discovered that my 90-day test was paying off. My relationship and influence did grow by focusing on what I could do to change the environment in which I worked. Today, the trust between my boss and me is very high, and I feel I'm making a real contribution here. I challenge you to think deeply about this first gift, to reflect on that space that exists between stimulus and response, and to use it wisely in enlarging your freedoms, in keeping yourself constantly growing, learning, and contributing. Eventually, your exercise of that power will enlarge the response until the very nature of your responses will begin to shape the stimuli. You literally create the world in which you live. The great American philosopher-psychologist William James consistently taught that when we change our thinking, we change our lives. Ella Wheeler Wilcox expressed it in this beautiful poem. Listen carefully. One ship drives east and another drives west. With the same self winds that blow, 'tis the set of the sails and not the gales that tell us the way to go. Like the winds of the sea are the ways of fate. As we voyage along through life, 'tis the set of a soul that decides its goal and not the calm or the strife. Now let's look at our second birth gift. Natural laws or principles. We've been discussing the wise use of the space between stimulus and response, that is, our freedom to choose. But what does wise use mean? Where is wisdom? Basically, I suggest it means to live by principles or natural laws rather than going along with today's culture of quick fix and expediency. Once Einstein saw the needle of a compass at the age of 4, he always understood that there had to be something beneath things, something deeply hidden. This also pertains to every other realm of life. Principles are universal, that is, they transcend culture and geography. They're also timeless, they never change. Principles such as fairness, kindness, respect, honesty, integrity, service, contribution, growth and development. Different cultures may translate these principles into different practices, and over time may even totally obscure these principles through the wrongful use of freedom. Nevertheless, they are present. Like the law of gravity, they operate constantly. Another thing I've discovered is that these principles are inarguable. That is, they are self-evident. As I mentioned before, you can never have enduring trust without trustworthiness. Just think about it. That is a natural law. I remember once serving as an assistant survival instructor to a group of about 30 people. After going about 24 hours without any food, water, or sleep, we climbed down a mountain and needed to cross a raging river to get to our food and water on the other side. There was a rope stretched from one tree on one bank to a tree on the other bank, where breakfast was available. I volunteered to go first. Thinking that I was much stronger than I actually was, I started bouncing and fooling around in the middle of the rope rather than utilizing all of my strength to get